I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE in the Middle East. Today, U.S. President Trump is scheduled to meet with interim Syrian dictator and ex-Al-Qaeda commander Jalani in the White House. It's the first time a president of the relatively recently created United States hosts a leader based in the ancient capital of Damascus. The meeting with quasi-Al-Qaeda comes almost a year after the elected president of Syria, Bashar al-Assad, who we interviewed during the proxy war, was overthrown by a jihadist group linked to Al-Qaeda, which the USA then deemed a terrorist organization. Without the MI6 CIA-facilitated fall of Assad, it's arguable how far the genocide in Gaza could have continued. Already, NATO nation media has erased Gaza from its news broadcasts as if 2 years of NATO nation armed genocide can be forgotten. This is Israel still denies food promised in the Trump ceasefire deal, and that's against a backdrop of a U.S.-funded Israel invading Syria after bombing Tunisia, Yemen, Iraq, Lebanon, and Iran. Professor Nick Maynard, who was with the first group of medics to enter Gaza at the start of the systemic genocide, an associate professor of surgery at the University of Oxford and gastrointestinal surgery consultant. He has been volunteering at Nasser Hospital in Gaza since 2010. Nasser Hospital is the last remaining large-scale medical facility still functioning in Gaza, despite having been bombed with UK, US, EU multi-million dollar weaponry. He joins me now from Oxford in the UK. Dr. Maynard, I'll spare the fact that surgeons are called Mr. in Britain, because we have more interesting things to say. Because internationally, you're a doctor. You've co-authored this piece in the British Medical Journal, saying, and I quote, "History shows that what medicine once defended as neutrality under slavery, apartheid, and Nazism was later condemned as complicity." Why do you believe then that the General Medical Council, the Royal Colleges, NHS England, these are British institutions, I should say, I once worked at the General Medical Council, why have none of them condemned the UK-owned armed genocide?
The short answer is I don't know. I mean, I believe that, and as this article makes clear, I believe that all healthcare professionals, all medical institutions, all medical schools, universities have a fundamental ethical obligation to call out such war crimes against healthcare workers, such clear evidence of genocide. And I think our medical institutions, our medical media, our academic institutions have been what they claim to be neutral, but what we would claim to be complicit in this genocide. They have failed in their duty, in their ethical obligation, to call out the appalling war crimes, the appalling genocide, the direct targeting of healthcare institutions, the direct targeting of healthcare workers. And they need to speak up and call this out, and they failed to do so.
The great thing about your work is that you have managed to garner some even so-called mainstream media attention. People can watch interviews with you and the ashen faces of the presenters, as you describe volunteering way before October 7th in Gaza, trying to explain and get through to presenters, to journalists, what on earth is going on. I could have asked you, people can watch those interviews. What's it like being on media, clearly Israeli-biased media, they won't use the genocide word, in Britain and beyond? I mean, they've been repeating that the hospitals are Hamas headquarters for years, and you're there politely explaining to them the reality. What's it like being in the chair?
Yeah, well, it's sometimes difficult to be polite under those circumstances. Before the last 2 years, I'd never done any media interviews at all. I've just been a surgeon working hard in Oxford, going out once or twice a year to Gaza and the West Bank. But these last 2 years, I've had multiple trips out to Gaza, and I have seen such appalling atrocities, such clear evidence of war crimes and genocide, that I felt an overriding duty and obligation, as indeed many other colleagues of mine who've seen similar things in Gaza. We felt this absolute duty to call it out and to speak out about it. And I think our media has been utterly shameful in the way they have failed to tell the truth about what is going on in Gaza. They have been presented with a huge amount of evidence by me and many other healthcare workers, photographic evidence, very detailed personal testimonies, and they have failed to portray it adequately. And they still, as you point out, continue to propagate the Israeli propaganda, such as Hamas using the hospital's command centers, such as the Israeli military doing their best to protect civilians. These claims by the Israeli spokespeople, have never presented any verifiable or credible evidence. And yet many of us have presented very clear evidence to our media, to our government, and they have shamefully refused, for whatever reason, to present this in an objective fashion. So I am appalled by their behaviour, and I think they need to be called out, because they claim this is a balanced view, and of course it is not. They need to move away from this idea that they have to be neutral. They need to present the truth as it is presented to them, and they have failed to do so.
I mean, you're a gastrointestinal surgeon, not a psychiatrist, but then what does that say about the minds of these people that are, you say, complicit? Some would say co-belligerent, since information is part of the war on the children that you were seeing on a daily basis when you were based in Gaza.
Yeah, I mean, I can't explain. I think at the beginning, you know, 2 years ago, they could have claimed ignorance, but they cannot claim that anymore. I think there's an element of cowardice, that the accusation of anti-Semitism has been terribly weaponized over the last 2 years, and there's a lot of cowardice about being accused of being anti-Semitic. But I do not believe that is a sufficient excuse. I think there is clearly huge pressure on them to avoid telling the truth. But I mean, the honest truth is, I don't understand it. I think it's utterly shameful, and I think they need to be called out.
I mean, as you describe the horrors, I mean, it just, you know, it's difficult to imagine a human being listening to some of the testimony you've been giving that has been allowed some publicity, and them not to feel unmoved. I mean, you say cowardice. Not, you haven't really explained who is this mysterious force against humanity turning these journalists into monsters. I mean, perhaps I should just start with, I mean, any evidence to suggest that these soldiers, armed by Britain and the United States and the EU, were targeting young boys' genitalia and reproductive organs as part of the genocide when Trump had authorized the so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen the evidence. I mean, I've talked a lot about this, as you know, and I'm very careful. I describe what I have witnessed personally, or what very close friends, very old friends have witnessed, and whose testimonies I would believe without any doubt at all. But the predominant testimony I present is what I have seen with my own eyes. And I have seen, for example, 19 young teenage boys brought in succession, all of whom had been shot in the neck. I have seen 4 teenage boys brought in having been shot in the testicles. I didn't treat them because I'm not a urologist, but I was in the operating theatres when they arrived. I've seen multiple teenage boys brought in that I've operated on who've been shot systematically in the abdomen and the chest. And the pattern of the injuries, the targeting that we have witnessed, cannot be explained by coincidence. I have spoken to close friends of mine who've been present at the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation food distribution sites, who have witnessed the Israeli soldiers shooting these individuals. So there is no doubt in my mind what is going on. And yet our media, our government, seemingly do not accept this testimony. They prefer to believe, it would appear to me, the lies, the baseless propaganda coming out of the Israeli spokesman. I've seen this with my own eyes. And I think at some stage, our government, our media have to decide, do they want to believe this Israeli propaganda, for which there is no evidence and for which many claims have been disproved? Or do they want to believe the testimony of people like me and many other healthcare workers who've got no political agenda, we've got no axe to grind, we are humanitarians, we go out there to save lives, to treat people, and we are simply reporting what we are seeing?
In fairness, I mean, I'm not sure whether it is fair, Sir Keir Starmer, the British Prime Minister, elected, I've met him, he said, I think Israel does have that right, famously, when asked about whether Israel had the right to cut power and water off from Gaza. I don't know whether that means he would allow generators that you may have needed when you were treating patients. So it's very explicit. Britain has a democracy, and the British government are on the side of that. He tried to row back on it, or an aide did, but I think Israel does have that right. That's the government position.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think there couldn't be a clearer example of what many of us would call complicity. This has been going on for 2 years. I presented hardcore evidence to Lord Cameron when he was the Foreign Secretary, to Andrew Mitchell, the International Development Secretary. I showed them photographs, coloured photographs of children who'd been killed by Israeli bullets, children who'd lost their arms, who'd died of terrible burns. Appalling atrocities. So they have been given this clear evidence systematically for 2 years now, and yet they choose to ignore it. That statement.
I mean, in fairness to Cameron, he did say it was the largest open air, maybe after you gave him those photos. He said it was on the largest open air prison camps in the world. Andrew Mitchell's a friend of this show, or used to be, and he got into a strange saga after he started pronouncing on Palestine, it has to be said. How did you get into Gaza, by the way?
Sorry. But just to come back to you on that, yes, we've heard stronger rhetoric. We've heard statements from our various foreign secretaries, international development secretaries, prime ministers, but they've not been accompanied by actions. Our government still sells arms to Israel. Our government still flies reconnaissance flights, or the RAF flies reconnaissance flights from Cyprus over Gaza on a daily basis, providing intelligence. They have not provided imposed sufficient sanctions. So, yes, we can argue that the language coming out of our government has been stronger, but it has not been accompanied by appropriate actions, and therefore it is wholly inadequate what they've been saying.
And so how did you get into Gaza? Because, you know, obviously journalists haven't been able to get outside journalists. There are plenty of journalists getting killed in Gaza. How do you manage to get through the IDF cordons?
So we go through, the World Health Organization has an emergency medical team mechanism whereby they, so you go in as part of an NGO. I've been going in with Medical Aid for Palestinians, a UK-based charity. You go in under the auspices of the WHO. You have to get permission from the Israeli authorities. In the early part of this two-year conflict, we went in through Rafah, which is obviously not through an Israeli border, through the Egyptian border, but we still had to be sanctioned by the Israeli authorities. Since May the 6th last year, we've had to go in through Jordan and then across Israel. And of course, that has been entirely under Israeli control. So we have to get permission for the Israeli authorities. So we form a team. The NGO, such as MAP, puts our names forward. We get permission or not from the Israeli authorities. And of course, in the last 2 or 3 months, up to 80% of medics who've tried to go and have been denied entry. So it's very much up to the whim of the Israeli authorities. And only when you get permission can you actually cross the border to go in. And they are turning most people down now.
Professor Nick Maynard, I'll stop you there. More from the volunteer surgeon at Gaza's Nasser Hospital after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the Oxford University Hospital surgeon who's been volunteering in Gaza for 15 years, Professor Nick Maynard. Nick, you were talking about getting through these barriers, these borders, the under siege Gaza Strip. Were you treated differently because you're of a certain class compared to other people trying to get in? What are the sort of questions being asked at these borders around Gaza to allow medics into an area under siege?
We're not really asked questions when we go through. I think the decision-making as to whether we can get in is made before we get there. So we typically fly into Amman, and then we only hear the night before whether we've been granted permission. But once that permission has been given, we're not grilled at the border. We're searched by the Israeli border guards, but we're not undergoing any form of interrogation or questioning to go through. I think the permission has been granted then. We're just searched, and many things may be taken from our possession, but we're not actually questioned at that time.
And why do you think Israel allows doctors in. Israel, of course, continually said right through over the 2 years, it's targeting Hamas. Your experience clearly shows that it was indiscriminate. Why do they allow doctors of any kind in? Obviously not enough, clearly. And doctors, I understand, without the necessary equipment and medicines and basic anesthesia to be able to do their work.
Well, I mean, international law obliges them to allow medics in, so perhaps the more pertinent...
Yeah, they never care about that. They don't tend to care about that.
I completely agree with you. They don't care about that. And the more pertinent question, why do they refuse so many people to go in? Why do they take medicines out of our luggage? Why do they take food products that are destined for example, babies when we take in formula feed? Why do they not allow us to take in medical equipment? I don't know why they refuse all of that. And my only explanation is it's part of their policy of targeting healthcare workers and part of their policy of ethnically cleansing Gaza.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure the main funders of Israel in the White House saw that intelligence, as it were, from their officials. You're not a pediatrician, but you mentioned baby formula there. Tell me about one baby, Zainab, who you visited in the wards, who you have talked about.
Yeah, I mean, she wasn't a patient of mine because as you say, I'm not a pediatrician, but I had some pediatric patients I'd operated on who are on the intensive care unit at Nasser Hospital. So I used to see little baby Zainab every day, actually. I used to go and talk to her mother. Baby Zainab was 7 months old. She looked like a newborn. She was skeletally thin, profoundly malnourished, and there was no feed to give her. Her mother couldn't breastfeed her because she was so malnourished. Little baby Zainab needed formula feed. And when I was there, and this was back in June and July, there was no formula feed in Nasser Hospital to give her. And she died 2 weeks into my trip there. She died entirely and exclusively of starvation imposed by the Israeli blockade. And what made it even more tragic was that 4 days before she died, some American doctors who were coming in to join me and my colleagues in Nasser Hospital, knowing there was a shortage of formula feed, brought in multiple cartons or containers of formula feed in their luggage, only for it all to be confiscated, all to be removed by the Israeli border guards when they were trying to enter Gaza. Now, they claim they take things out of our luggage that could conceivably be used as weapons or such like. It is impossible for me to imagine what formula feed can be used for other than feeding babies and saving their lives. And yet it was all taken away, every single container confiscated. And that is, you know, the clearest evidence possible of a war crime, of a blockade of essential food going in to save lives. So there's no doubt in my mind this little baby was starved to death by the Israeli blockade.
I mean, the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, presumably we've seen the last of, but it seemed to me that NATO nations that were funding Israel, supplying the arms, just shrugged their shoulders about this plan of humanitarian aid distribution. Britain closely involved in Israel's drone program. Did you witness any of the drones killing malnourished people as part of the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation plan?
Yes, I did. I saw many patients have been shot by drones in all three of my trips since October the 7th. But the last trip, when I was based in Nasser in June and July last year, we had several patients who'd been shot by the quadcopter drones in tents right next to the GHF food distribution point. And there were two young ladies I operated on, both had been shot. One of them was 3 months pregnant and was resting in a tent. I call it a tent. Of course, they're not proper tents. They're makeshift shelters. And another lady who was breastfeeding her seven-month-old baby. They were both shot when quadcopters were indiscriminately firing at all the tents, trying to shoot everyone inside them. Both of them were shot in the abdomen. Both of them had life-threatening injuries I operated on, and they survived. And very fortunately, the lady who was pregnant, the uterus, the baby survived. But this was, again, clear evidence of the quadcopter drones shooting these individuals. And I saw people who'd been shot by the quadcopters in Nasser Hospital. A friend of mine was shot in the operating theatre complex of NASA Hospital. Inside the building, a quadcopter was remotely controlled and flown into the hospital and shot this individual. So we saw some terrible injuries from the quadcopter drones.
You see, I mean, in the Financial Times, it says here, the tricky path to a defence dividend. And the fact is, billions of dollars are being made from the effects that you've been watching in Gaza. BAE Systems, Elbit, Leonardo, Thales, MBDA. Do you think it would make some kind of impact if they all went on strike? Or can you see how the powers that be see the effects of what you saw as money-making opportunities?
Yeah, well, they know what damage these weapons are doing. They've seen the evidence from me and many, many others, but they choose to allow these to continue. It's perhaps naive of us to believe that if Britain took a stance and stopped all the weapons going, that it would make a huge difference, because the American impact is by far the greatest. But I think if our country and indeed the European countries took a firm stance and stopped all this, I think that would have an impact, and that would increase the pressure on America to stop Israel. So the argument that the British contribution is an insignificant one and by itself would not make a difference, I think is a false argument, because I think it would increase the pressure undoubtedly and increase the pressure from the European Union to provide pressure to put pressure on the Israelis. So yes, we should be stopping all weapons, all arms going there, and we're failing to do so.
We've interviewed on this show relatives of those who survived the Holocaust in Western Europe. How far did survivor's guilt affect medics going in to Gaza as you left Gaza? I'm not sure when you're next going back, but what happened psychologically?
It's a very interesting question. I think when we all leave Gaza, you have this very complex set of emotions. There's clearly relief, you're going home to see your loved ones, but immense sadness because you're leaving colleagues behind who you know may be killed and you may never see again. You're leaving your patients behind. But you're absolutely right. You feel a lot of guilt that you're able to leave and that your friends and colleagues aren't able to leave. So we all start planning as soon as possible to go back. And of course, that's a bit of a lottery. We want to go back very rapidly. But many of us cannot get in any further. I mean, I haven't tried to get in since July, but I'm hoping to go back in the new year. But three close friends of mine tried to get in 3 weeks ago and were denied entry. You know, this is after the supposed ceasefire has taken place, and yet there are still upwards of 80% of doctors and nurses who are being refused entry by the Israelis, despite the fact there's meant to be a ceasefire at the moment. So, yes, I think everyone wants to go back as soon as they possibly can, because they have this complex set of emotions. They feel guilty that they've left and their friends can't leave. So, yes, we all want to go back there.
Yeah, I mean, here in the Dubai press, what kind of truce is this? We just started to breathe again when the bombardment came back, bringing war, explosions, death. And you're saying, again, they're not allowing medics in. You saved lives there, but then used your voice. I understand, though, you were prevented from addressing a global health symposium at Ohio State University. Just tell me about why information is a crime in the land of the First Amendment when it comes to personal experience of genocide.
Well, I'm not sure I can explain the reasoning behind it. I was invited out as a keynote speaker for the Global Health Symposium in Ohio, in Columbus at Ohio State University earlier this year. And about 2 weeks beforehand, I got an email from the dean of the university cancelling my visit. The title of my talk, of my keynote speech, I was going to be given various talks. The title of my keynote speech was Gaza, a War Against Healthcare, which, of course, is the thrust of what I talk about. And they clearly cancelled me on the basis of the fact that I was going to be talking about Gaza. Now, whether that was pressure from the Trump administration or not, I do not know. But I was told I was no longer welcome and the whole symposium would be cancelled. The people who'd organised it wonderful, inspirational people at a Ohio State University asked me whether I would still come out, and they held all the symposia at different venues. And indeed, I gave more talks than I had been originally planned to give. I had probably bigger audiences, and it attracted a lot of media attention. So one might argue it backfired on the university dean for cancelling the trip. But it was yet another example of medical academic institutions, both in the States and in my country, in the UK, being silent and preventing people talking about the atrocities that are being perpetrated out there.
Just finally, have you spoken to any colleagues in the Nasser hospital in the past few days? Obviously, since the ceasefire went into effect, it's not really a ceasefire at all, is it? I don't even know why anyone calls it that.
It's not. And I was speaking yesterday to a close friend, a UK surgeon who managed to get in against the odds. He's there at the moment, and they are still receiving many victims of bombings, predominantly less shootings now, but many, many victims of explosive injuries. And each day there are upwards of 40, up to 100 people being killed every day in Gaza. So this notion that there is a ceasefire, that the Israelis are not attacking, is a nonsense. There may be a reduced amount of explosive injuries, but there are still many people being killed every single day.
But at least better supplies of urgent medical equipment and
yes, there has been an improvement. There is aid going in. There is food going in. But again, nothing like enough. And nothing like enough that was guaranteed or contracted to be supplied during the ceasefire. So we all recognise that they probably need upwards of 1,000 trucks of aid and food going in every day. And nothing like that is going in. So yes, of course, we welcome that which is going in, but it is nothing like enough. And we must not kid ourselves that there is a proper ceasefire and that unlimited aid is going in. That is what was needed. That is what was promised. And it's not happening.
Professor Nick Maynard, thank you.
Thank you very much indeed.
That's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those bereaved by the UK-US EU armed genocide across Palestine. We'll be back on Saturday with a brand new episode. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Saturday.